Hi, Steve.
Hi, Will.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thanks. And you?
I'm doing very, very well. Thanks for coming on Free Will on Blogging Heads TV. I'm Will Wilkinson at the Cato Institute, and you are Stephen A. Marglin, the Walter S. Barker Professor of Economics at Harvard. Is that correct?
That's it. At least last time I looked, I was. You never know, but last time I looked, that's my title.
That's still what you are, and we're here to talk today about your book, The Dismal Science, How Thinking Like an Economist Undermines Community. Now, as you know, I'm at the Cato Institute, so you might expect this to be a book that I would have some disagreements with. I also blog for The Economist, so I think I'm the I've got the gold-plated neoliberal credentials. But I found your book really interesting and really stimulating. You have touch on a lot of themes that are central to stuff that I've been working on. I just find that there's a saying that we have in philosophy, which is what I was trained in, is that one man's modus ponens is another man's modus tollens. And so some of your arguments against thinking like an economist and thinking about markets are exactly why I like them. So I want to get into that a little bit as we go on. So first of all, tell us about, can you just give us a brief overview of what your book is about and how you came to write it?
Well, the first is easier than the second. The first is, the book really makes two points. One is that markets undermine community, and the second is that economics is the enabler. Economics aids and abets markets, and therefore is an accessory before and after the fact in terms of what I would regard as a crime and what you would probably regard as a virtue, the undermining of community.
Sometimes,
Yeah. Well, for me, the question is one of balance. It's not, I begin the book with a quote from the Jewish sage of the first century, Rabbi Hillel, who says, "If I am not for me, who will be?" That's the individual side. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to say, "But if I am only for me, what am I?" And I think what's happened over the last 400 years, the period of modernity, is that we've lost that balance that Rabbi Hillel expressed so well 2,000 years ago. So it's not that I think that all community is good, and it's not that this book is not a romanticization of the past, and I'm certainly aware of all kinds of oppressions that take place in the name of community. I gave a talk about a month ago on this book in Colorado. There was a bearded fellow in the audience who came up to me afterwards, because as you know, I talk a lot about the Amish in this book.
Right.
And he said that, he was glad that I took such a balanced view, because he'd grown up in a Mennonite community and had experienced both the good and the bad. The bad for him was that he's gay, and there was no place for him in the Mennonite community. Well, I would share your libertarian perspective on people's right to a sex life of their own, regardless of whether that's with others of the same sex or of the other sex. So, I'm not for that the kind of oppression that this fellow experienced. But what I think we have lost in the process of modernization is some balance between the claims of the community and the claims of the individual.
Okay, well, let's talk. There's a couple things in there that I want to address. First of all, I want to talk about the example that you begin with about the Amish community that chooses to forego a treatment that would save a child's life in order to sort of avoid violating the norms that hold the community together, and it wasn't clear to me the extent to which you thought that was a sort of horrible thing or
a
good thing.
I'm sorry, a what thing? What was the first thing you said?
Whether that was a sort of a monstrous thing to allow a child to die, or whether it was somewhat noble because it helped keep the norms of the community intact?
Well, let me say, as a parent, I could never make the decision that these Amish people made. So in terms of my personal values, this is not a decision that I could make or be sympathetic with at the personal level. What is, I think, remarkable about the Amish, and this is true not only in this dramatic case, but in their everyday life, and this is the value I think we can all learn from the Amish, is that they do take account explicitly of community in decisions. And, okay, in my judgment, they carry this sometimes to an extreme, and sometimes they make the wrong decisions, but that they take account of the effects on community is, to me, both remarkable and admirable. Let me give you another example, which appears later on in the book. I don't know, you're probably of a younger vintage, and you may not remember the movie Witness that appeared, I think.
Sure.
You remember Witness, okay. Well, you may remember there's this scene of barn raising where the men put up the barn and the women cook and the kids play and everybody, it looks like a great exercise in nostalgia.
Right.
It has a very serious purpose for the Amish. I have a barn. I have horses and I have a barn. My barn burns down. What do? I call my insurance adjuster. Insurance adjuster comes out, he verifies the barn's burned down, he cuts me a check for whatever, $60,000, I don't know what's probably worth a lot more than that now, $60,000, $100,000, whatever it would cost to replace the barn, and I hire a contractor, and the contractor will hire subs, and the barn gets rebuilt. Series of economic market transactions. The Amish have determined, and again, you can question the specifics on any one case, but not, I think, the idea of taking into account the effects of community on community. The Amish have determined that insurance undermines community and undermines the solidarity of people taking care of each other. And they reject insurance for fire insurance, they reject life insurance, they do not participate in government programs of Social Security, all on the same basis that people ought to be taking care of each other and that that's necessary to sustain the community. Economists will argue, well, it's as far as building barns are concerned, it's more efficient to build barns using the market rather than bringing together members of the community. That's probably true if your focus is on barns, and it may be true even if your focus is on the individuals who use the barns. But if you focus on the community, then I think there's a lot to be said for the Amish position that that reinforcing ties of affinity by ties of economic necessity, economic reciprocity, is important to sustaining the community. So the lesson from the Amish is not what they do in any one particular case. It's that they consciously look at the effects of the market not only on producing goods and services in the economist traditional sense of the term, but in the effects of economic relations on community. And that's something we do not do in the larger society, and I think we could learn from the Amish in that respect.
Yeah, there's such a rich vein of topics in what you just said. I like I said, I came from philosophy, and I learned economics from the outside when I was working at the Mercatus Center at George Mason. And most of the economics that I learned from reading people like Hayek and from people involved in a project that I helped run, and those people were like the economic historian Douglas North and Vernon Smith, the experimental economist. And one of the themes that runs through Hayek and Doug North's work and Vernon Smith's experimental work is the idea of this transition between regimes of personal to impersonal exchange. That the big story of modernity is this transition from small communities that are based in reciprocity, reputation, you know, tight signaling of solidarity through certain kinds of ceremonies and sacrifice and so forth, to this more abstract extended order that runs on mechanisms of like insurance and credit ratings and things like that, that allow for the extent of economic exchange to expand massively, and then there are huge gains from the massive expansion of the scope of the market and the intensity of the division of labor, and so on and so forth. So there's, to a large extent, it seems that if they're kind of right about the history, that a lot of the prosperity that we enjoy and a lot of the well-being, the level of well-being that we enjoy, is partly a function of making this transition to impersonal exchange. But that seems to be exactly what it is that you're concerned about.
Well, you've raised a number of rich veins in your question, so let me try to deal with them in some kind of coherent order, and I hope if
sure.
I miss, we'll be able to backtrack and pick them up. Let's take Hayek. I regard Hayek as one of the great economists of the 20th century, and this is not something I'm saying to you as coming from the Cato Institute. It's right there in the Dismal Science. His great contribution, I think, is his understanding of the role of experiential knowledge. In this very important article which he published in the 1940s called The Use of Knowledge in Society, I may have the title slightly wrong, but if you have the book in front of you, you could...
I think that's it, yeah.
You could check the reference. And this was his response to a debate which is now, ancient history, really, about the possibility of efficient allocation of resources in a socialist economy.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, interestingly enough, he was regarded as the loser in this debate, and not just by people coming at it from a socialist perspective. I'm talking about the mainstream of the economics profession.
Right.
I regard him as having been the winner in the sense that he had, I think, the most important insight, which is namely that what the argument for efficient allocation of in a socialist economy basically said something like this. You can do all this. You don't need real markets. You can imitate markets, and you can do everything on a as-if basis, on paper calculation. Now, you know, there's a lot more to the story, but I think that will frame it sufficiently.
Yeah.
He made the point that you need real markets in order to mobilize the kind of particular experiential knowledge that economic agents have that they may not even be aware of in a way that they could put down on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And this I regard as the great virtue of markets and what markets have brought to the allocation of resources and, as you said, the great expansion of economic activity and economic material well-being that we've enjoyed, and certainly in the rich countries over a period mm-hmm. of, 400 years, let's say, to put, an outside limit on it. All right, so if I have this high view of Hayek, mm-hmm. what's my criticism? Well, my criticism is many-fold. First of all, especially we in the rich countries, and I'm not talking now about India or China or Africa or large parts of Latin America, but mm-hmm. We in the rich countries have, I think, relatively little need for further increase in our material standard of living. We have the basis already of providing a decent, dignified standard of life for all our citizens. We don't need further expansion, number one. Number two, I believe that, again, that there's an upside and a downside. And the downside of the further expansion of the economy is precisely what I argue in the book, that it undermines community. And I think that, again, we are out of balance. We've lost the balance, and that we need to restore that balance. The argument that I'm making, as I say, is an argument about community and about human relations, but it's clearly reinforced by the ecological problem that we are facing, not only of climate change, but more generally of resource exhaustion. Now, that's a huge problem, and it really is outside the scope of my book, and I know there are various perspectives on it, including the argument that we've always had technological fixes in the past, and we'll always be able to fix whatever resource shortages there are in the future by means of another technological fix. I don't really have a position on that point of view versus the point of view that these technological fixes are really Russian roulette, and some point or other the bullet's going to be in the chamber, and we're not going to find a technological fix. Rather, we're going to blow ourselves up. Those are two different positions. I don't know which of them is right, but from my perspective, since whichever position is right about ecology, I side with the people who say, let's slow down because we have enough, and further expansion is going to put us further out of balance in terms of what we do to communities. So come back to Hayek. Two cheers for Hayek, but not three, because Hayek is really belongs to another era when we could not say, I think, that we have enough, let's slow down.
Oh, let's come back in a little bit to the question of whether we have enough. That's a big question that I want to tackle.
Sure.
But before we talk more about that, let's talk a little bit more about what the good of community is. So if as you say, community is being undermined by the market and being enabled by the economic way of thinking, what is it that's being lost? What's so good about communities that we need to be concerned about?
What's being lost is human relationships, and human relationships are part of the essence of being human. That's it in a nutshell.
What evidence do you appeal to show that human relationships are eroding in a troubling kind of way? What's the data on that that should cause us to be worried?
Well, the data is everywhere you want to look. The data is in, for instance, what happens to the elderly in our society. If the elderly are lucky, they end up in clean nursing homes that are well run and well operated, and with sympathetic staff and not overworked staff, and with plenty of economic resources. If they're unlucky, they end up in dirty places that you wouldn't want your worst enemy to be in. Mm-hmm. But nobody, or virtually nobody, there are obviously some exceptions, but very few elderly people in the United States can hope to spend their last days or their last years connected to their families, that is, with their children, with their grandchildren, and so forth. This is nobody's fault. It's not their children are stressed to the max, taking care of their own children, and generally now, or very frequently now, both partners in a marriage are working on jobs outside the home. They're not in a position to take care of their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I'm assigning blame or anything, but. The fact is that the structure of our society, the absence of community, the first community being the family, we pay a huge price for that. The elderly pay the price. I think our children pay the price. The young children who go to daycare from age as young as 1 month, I think they're paying the price, and their parents are paying the price for the absence of community. My daughter-in-law just had her third child, and she is fortunate enough to be able to stay home with Micah. My daughter had a child about the same time, and she had to go back to work after about 6 months, and she was lucky at that because many mothers can't even stay home for 6 months with their children. Mm-hmm. But she would have mm-hmm. loved to stay home for another 6 months, year, whatever, and I think it would have been good for her, it would have been good for her husband, it would have been good for their child, but not economically feasible in our society. So, you know, the evidence is all around you. I think...
Well, that sounds... I agree to some extent, but it largely sounds... some of it sounds anecdotal in the sense... my last large project was on how to measure happiness and life satisfaction. And there's, you know, just lots of different... There's a large number of different trends going on in society, a lot of them that are caused at a fundamental level by changes in the economic structure. And I would agree with you that changes in family structure are real responses to changes in the nature of economic opportunity. Mm-hmm. I edited a thing for the Cato Institute called Cato Unbound that discusses different issues every month. And last month we had an issue on marriage and the family, and we had a historian, Stephanie Kuntz, who sort of mm-hmm. gave a history of the changes of marriage. But we also had a couple of economists from Penn, Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson, and they made the argument that family structure has changed in part because people have gotten wealthier. And as people get wealthier, their attitude towards the family changes. So in conditions of greater scarcity, the family is a kind of production unit. The family is sort of the solidaristic unit that is producing together, producing certain kinds of family-level goods that they all share. And children are also, in this similar sense in which you were talking about the Amish, children are a kind of insurance, that you have children to serve as a kind of insurance for old age,
right.
And that there are these very tight family bonds.
Right.
As people accumulate enough, like, as incomes go up and people are able to self-insure over time, they depend less on their children for their retirement, and marriages become less a matter of economic necessity and more a matter of Wolfers and Stevenson were calling consumption partners. So partners in marriages become, they were calling it hedonic marriage, where partners in co-consumption of sort of household-level family goods, and children become more like certain kinds of luxuries and consumption goods. So we don't impose on our children to produce economic resources for the household, but the flip side of that is that it doesn't seem fair to ask your children to pay for your retirement. And so these changes, I think you're right, have a very large effect on the way the family is structured and the obligations people think that they have to one another within the family. But it's not clear to me whether on net that's liberating or a step back. For instance, those same mechanisms seem to be very instrumental in women's liberation over the last several decades.
Well, again, you've packed a lot into the question, and that's fine. I smile. I haven't read the articles that you referred to, but I think the arguments certainly make sense, certainly from an economist's point of view. What I would argue again is that there are losses, and indeed that the losses have outweighed the gains. Beyond, if you take the changes as a whole with regard to the effects on community. One thing that the economists generally leave out, they think of people mm-hmm. as sort of given, and mm-hmm. That people are formed somehow outside of their relationships with other people. So they think of the person who is involved in a close set of family relationships as exactly the same person who that you're describing put down somewhere else at a different time with a different set of resources is now just making different choices, but is the same person. I would argue that the people are shaped by their human relations, and we are shaped. We aren't born thinking of children that we might have as luxury consumption goods.
Right.
This is something which is formed into us by the kind of society we're in, and I think that's a real loss. I think it's a real loss when you come to think of your children as consumption goods, as your partnership, as a consumption partnership. And I agree with you, it's happened, but it blows my mind that people could think of this as a gain relative to relationship which is a relationship of depth and meaning. Now, this is not to say, again, I don't want to be boxed into a corner where I am, where it sounds like I am romanticizing the family, romanticizing the oppression of women, romanticizing all kinds of oppressive relationships between parents and children that have taken place in traditional families. But to argue on that basis against the family is, to me, to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Now, when you say that that you think there's a real loss in thinking of, say, like marriage as a consumption partnership.
Yes.
Again, as a matter of social science, what exactly is the loss? Are you saying that people are less satisfied with their lives, or they suffer health problems, or what? I'm wondering what's the sort of measurable negative effect, opposed to just this being a moral or aesthetic preference.
Well, Will, you have to get away from the idea that a measure of satisfaction is happiness or something is meaningful in a world in which people are shaped by their relationships. You're already presupposing the economist's assumption that somehow the people are there apart from how they're relating to other people. And then you can talk about, well, am I more happy in this situation or am I more happy in another situation, and you're comparing apples with apples. If people are formed by their relationships, then the idea that you can compare their happiness in one situation with their happiness in another is one of the things that goes by the boards, because you're really not talking about the same person anymore. You coming from philosophy should be sensitive to this debate. People coming from economics cannot conceive of the individual as anything other than a set of given preferences, and then the question is how well those preferences are satisfied, and preferences extend from the gamut from what kind of ice cream you like to what your moral judgments and your ethical values are. Whereas, again, for most people who do not come to these questions from economics, these are very different issues and shouldn't be mixed up.
I agree with you that coming from philosophy, the book project that I've been working on is one that accepts most of the assumptions that you make about how people form their preferences and desires. I don't personally think that people's sort of have just a fixed preference structure that just kind of grows up out of nowhere. I do think that people are incredibly socially embedded beings, that our preferences are constructed through our set of relationships with one another. So in a lot of ways, I'm more like a sociologist than an economist in the way I like to think about these questions. It's just not clear to me why we should see, say, the family and the preferences that you form from being embedded in that set of social relations, that the conception of your obligations and desires that come out of being sort of, in some sense, propagandized by the marketing apparatus of the family or your church or your community, why those are any more or less authentic or any more or less meaningful than the desires and the sense of obligations that arise out of just a different social structure. So the desires that I developed from seeing other people consume certain things, from watching advertisement, from watching television, that yes, my desires aren't formed ex nihilo, they're formed through the social structure, but it's not clear to me which social structure is the one that we want to privilege in saying, you know, which desires are the best ones, or which sense of obligation trumps some other competing set of obligations. So that's kind of what I'm probing to, and that's why I always end up resorting back to the kind of reductive social scientific measures, because I want to make sure that, say, that people who are fully invested in, say, a liberal market society are or aren't, in fact, worse off on some measurable dimension. Because if all it is, according to some conception of meaning, they're worse off, I'm just worried that lots of people have lots of different competing conceptions of meaning and that we won't be able to sort anything out in the long run.
Yes. This is not so easy to respond to. The attempt to settle these issues by means of some kind of measurable, quantifiable data that is reducible to individuals is already to prejudge the outcome, and it's already to put it in a framework of economics. Mm-hmm. When you raise the question, as you did, of how do you balance one set of obligations as against another, that's exactly the question I think we ought to be asking. Mm-hmm. It's not a question that comes out of the economic way of understanding the world or of being in the world, because for the economist there's no such thing as obligation. There's interest, but there's no obligation. And you may enter into an obligation to further an interest, but the primary thing is your interest. The obligation is a means to an end. Now, when you're using the term obligation, I didn't understand it as a means to some kind of interest reducible to some mm-hmm. kind of self-sufficient individual. So I think we may be more on the same wavelength than is suitable for a discussion between somebody who is thought of as a radical dissident economist and somebody coming from the Cato Institute. But I agree fully that this is a question of how you balance different, or the right question is a question of how you balance different obligations, how you balance being in the world as an individual as against mm-hmm. being in the world as a member, not of just one community, the family, but of many communities. Mm-hmm. And that these are fundamental questions of human existence. Can we get perhaps some data that might help us understand better? I hope that my book will stimulate people to look for such data. But I won't pretend that this is a book of, as you know from your reading of it, that this is a book which is quantitative and purports to settle questions by means of standard economistic techniques like running regressions and so forth.
Let's talk more about like competing obligations, because I think this is a fascinating question, because people do have, I think you differentiate at some point between community and association,
right,
and sort of mere affiliation. And it is the case that we are embedded in lots of different communities. So I'm a son and a brother. I'm also a coworker to the people in my office. I'm an Iowan and an American, and I'm a libertarian, and, you know, there's all sorts of sort of affiliations, memberships, communities, right. associations that I'm a part of, and a lot of times these things have conflicting obligations, and I have obligations in terms of, say, the contracts that I enter into in the market as well. It seems like what you're wanting to say is that the set of obligations that come to us from our family and the local communities in which we grow up and in which our characters are formed, those need to get a lot more weight than they're getting now. Is that?
Well, it's not just the family and mm-hmm. local communities. I think people are members, or many people are members of religious communities which extend beyond the national borders. I have a chapter on what I call the economics of tragic choices, the people who are forced to choose between working in sweatshops or something much worse, children selling themselves for sex, for example, is a much worse fate than sowing soccer balls in under sweatshop conditions. And I think part of the answer to that, and that leads to movements like the anti-sweatshop movement, like the fair trade movement, is an identification on the part of consumers in the rich North with these victims of tragic choices. Now, you can say that's a very strange place to look for community. Why look for community with some kid in Pakistan who is sowing soccer balls? Well, I think in a world in which we are very starved for community, people look in very odd places for it. It's not just the small local community, the family, the neighborhood, etc., though those, I think, are have suffered greatly under the market. But all communities, I think, from the small to the supranational communities, have suffered as against the one community that economists understand and have some identification with, is the national community, the community of the nation state. And I don't, again, it's not that I think there's anything illegitimate mm-hmm. about the nation state. I think it is one community. It's an important community for all of us, but it shouldn't be considered as the only community.
Yeah, let's talk more about that, because that's another point of intersection. When I read, and you have a chapter in your book which is a criticism of the sort of nationalistic assumptions of welfare economics.
Right.
And that is one of my big bugbears as well. I'm a kind of sort of liberal internationalist, and I'm like one of the I love globalization and free migration, and the idea that we're just going to tote up the gains to the nation state that you happen to live in and look at its distributional consequences in isolation from the gains that are occurring across the entire network of trade, which goes across boundaries, it is what I think economists aren't being... In fact, one of the guys who got me thinking most about this is you bring up several times in your book this this World Bank memo that's attributed to Larry Summers uh-huh. about sending the pollution to poorer sub-Saharan African countries. Yeah. I think that memo might have actually been written by one of your now colleagues at Harvard, Lant Pritchett, who has actually opened up my eyes by thinking like an economist, because one of the things that economists are good at is taking individuals as individuals, but also sort of weighting their interests equally. And so one of the things that thinking about the economist, an economist helps you do is to not be a sort of morally chauvinistic. You have to take the interests of the people at the other end of the trade just as highly as your interests. And when it comes to, say, questions of migration, the gains to be had from even a small increase in immigration to the wealthy OECD countries is enormous to people from poor countries. So thinking of it like an economist helps you take fully into account the interests of people who are poor outside your national community. But then when I make that kind of argument, the pushback I get is a very strong sort of, I want to say, almost a chauvinistic kind of communitarian pushback that, no, by letting these immigrants into our community, we erode the identity, the ethno-cultural construct that we take to be part of our identity. And so that's a case where I worry that thinking like an economist actually makes you sort of more liberal and humane, and the communitarian impulse is what causes us to seal our borders and to sort of close off our communities.
Well, again, there's a lot to unpack there.
Sorry, I'm too stimulated by you.
Well, you know, no apology necessary. It's just I've got to keep in mind a number of things as I'm responding to you.
Yeah.
First of all, there is no church of economics, and there's certainly no pope who decides what is standard economics and what is dissident economics. I mean, when I talk about economics, and I don't always qualify, sometimes I say mainstream economics or standard economics, but it, you know, it gets kind of tedious always to be qualifying.
Yeah.
Moreover, I would argue that there is a very important mainstream, and what's happened, especially over my career, which now is more than 40 years as an economist, has been a drying up of a lot of other streams, and the mainstream is about all there is. And I'm trying to characterize as fairly as I can what the mainstream view is, and I think the mainstream view is not the one that's based on the effects on communities of immigration. It's rather the economic effects. And I remember when NAFTA was passed, there was NAFTA was legislation that was hundreds of pages. And
right.
I think very few economists actually read it. I certainly didn't. But the economists signed on to this.
Hi, Steve. I got cut off briefly. Sorry about that.
Okay.
I think you were in the middle of telling us about how economists had failed to actually look at the details of NAFTA. Rather, they just supposed it was a good thing because it was free trade.
Because it was free trade and it fits economists' prejudice. But I think my main point is that economists weren't looking at the effects on community. They weren't looking at the effects of communities in Ohio or Michigan and the real damage that's done to community when good jobs are lost and people have to take either jobs that are inferior in pay and benefits and really don't support a family, or they have to move and follow the money. Moving and following the money is great if you're 25 years old and you have no commitments, you have no kids who've been in school and so forth. Very different thing if you're 40, 50, you have a couple of kids in high school and so forth. There's a wonderful piece written by Dana Milbank in a newspaper that you may or may not read. Dana Milbank is now an op-ed columnist in the Washington Post, but years ago he was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And he wrote a wonderful piece, I refer to it in my book, on what happened to a family that did what the economists say. They went out, the guy lost his job due to plant closing or outsourcing or something, and so he went where the jobs were and where the money was, and it took a huge toll on his family. I won't recite the litany of disaster, but it ended up with the last act was the last time they moved, they have to shoot the family dog because there's no place in the van to put the dog. But many disasters on the way. But anyway, so my point is that the economist doesn't look at the effects on community because our way of understanding the world blinds us, makes community invisible. We don't look at the effects on community on the other side of the border either. The destruction of Mexican rural communities by the influx of cheap feed and food grains from the United States and the toll that took on local communities in Mexico. And the blowback in terms of people doing what they had to do to support their families, moving to the cities in Mexico, but also moving across the border to the United States. So, again, it's not that the I want to say that the benefits that you look at in terms of globalization and your argument that one should look outside beyond the national borders, I don't want to say that's wrong. What I want to say is it's incomplete, because I don't hear anything in what you say about looking at the effects on community. It seems to me you're still stuck in this paradigm of looking at goods and services, GDP, and counting it up and seeing whether it's higher under one regime or another. And I certainly don't want to argue that the poor should stay poor, but I want to argue that there is that not by bread alone, looking at material consumption is not sufficient.
Well, I think that gets to probably one of the crux of our disagreement is about whether we really do have enough thus far. You're saying that in the sort of developed rich countries that we've sort of attained a sort of sufficient level of material well-being. I mean, certainly you don't think that that the average rural Mexican is in a position of sort of material comfort, do you?
But the average rural Mexican is not living in a rich country. When I'm talking about rich countries, I'm talking about the United States, Western Europe,
but that's
Japan.
What I mean, like, with the...
Oh, I'm not at all saying that this goes for the rest of the world and that the China, India, Africa, Mexico, Latin America in general should not be concerned with increasing their material level of well-being. I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying is that they should do it in a smarter way than we have. They should take account, as the Amish do, of how the market impacts what's very valuable in these countries, namely a strong sense of community. Now, again, it's not when I say community is valuable and that this is something to be treasured, I don't mean to defend and to preserve every aspect of community. I do not mean to ignore the very real oppressions that take place in community, but I would say that these ought to be resolved and modified not by the wild influx of the market and the destruction of all that is good along with all that is bad, but by people who are committed within these countries and within these communities, both to improving the material standard of living and to preserving what's good in communities and to changing what needs to be changed.
Well, the point of my last question was really that I recently talked on this show to Douglas Massey, who's a sociologist at Princeton, and he heads a project on Mexican migration. And I was talking about NAFTA, and he said he thinks the biggest effect of NAFTA so far has been that it gave the Mexican government a pretext to implement a number of economic reforms that have been quite good in improving the overall standard of living in Mexico. And so the question that I had is, to what extent is one community and a trump on larger economic reforms? So if there's a community in the Rust Belt that's going to be decimated by a free trade pact, that would, in fact, benefit the poorer country a great deal. Does that community in the richer country get to trump the policy that would have an overall good effect, especially for the poorer people?
Trump automatically? No, certainly not. But when you put the question that way, you put it in terms of a conscious decision in which the interests and well-being of various players are being balanced. That's not the way NAFTA has worked, and that's not the way the extension of markets has worked. It's worked, been totally out of control, and nobody has asked the question that's implicit in your question of trumping, namely, how do we balance the effects on community? How do we balance the effects on people in Ohio and the effects of people in rural Mexico with the effects on people as consumers or people either in the United States or in Mexico? These are very real and legitimate questions, but they are not faced in the economic way of understanding the world, because the economic way of understanding the world says what matters is efficiency, what matters is more goods and services. That's objective. That's something that we can all agree on. Everything else is divisive. Everything else is subjective. Mm-hmm. Everything else is a matter of opinion.
Yeah. So let's say something about about what kind of community that you're looking for, because you've said a number of times that you don't mean to dismiss the ways that local communities can be repressive, that they can deny people their autonomy, that they can kind of be they could be conformist in a stifling way. You don't mean to deny any of those things,
no.
Which led me to have this question, because I guess I would commit, you know, characterize your view as broadly communitarian. And I've always understood what I think are right-wing communitarians quite well, partly because sort of thick, tightly knit communities throughout history tend to be extremely conservative. They tend to be have a very strong sexual division of labor. Women do this, men do that. There tends to be a very clear sort of hierarchy of power, status, deference, and dominance. And all of that kind of plays into what I think is a more conservative view of the world. So I'm thinking more of something like a sort of perhaps a conservative Muslim community in the Middle East as a kind of communitarianism that makes sense to me. The sort of idea of sort of progressive egalitarian communitarianism, this kind of the tightly knit Gemeinschaft where everyone is equal and there aren't sort of invidious distinctions between types of people. I just don't know where that exists, and so I'm wondering about whether or not that's something that you think is really feasible, or something that we could actually build towards.
Well, we won't know unless we try. I think it remains to be seen how feasible it is. I agree with you. There aren't many examples. I certainly don't think we can look, for example, to the Amish as a model or a template, and let's all become Amish men and women for many of the reasons that you have suggested. But we won't know unless we try, number one. Number two, we won't be able to get there if we approach the project with an economist's mindset in which the question is already decided because community doesn't exist. All that exists at most is, or at best, is associations that people enter into in order to advance their individual interests. And that is not what community is about. So it remains, I think you put it very well, it remains an open question, and I think we should be working in that direction, we should be, what I hope my book will do is what I regard as a preliminary task, and that is to expose the limits of the economic way of understanding the world and being in the world, relative to the project of precisely of building a community which is open, tolerant. I'm not so concerned that it be exactly egalitarian. It's a question of what kinds of inequalities and what kinds of differences we are prepared to countenance. And I think that's an issue we should be discussing, and one that we don't want to close off. but certainly openness, tolerance, the ability to change are important aspects of community. And let me say that the most conservative, the most, you could almost say, rejectionist communities are communities who feel their backs are to the wall, that if they change, they may disintegrate. Communities which do not have their backs to the wall, I think, are in general much more open to change, not to any kind of change, of course, but to change on certain terms. And that's really the question. The question is, on what terms does change take place? Does change take place on the basis of an out-of-control globalization that is based on what I would regard a very limited way of understanding and being in the world, or does it take place in terms of a kind of consciousness of the values that are being worn down, undermined, destroyed by the market? And let me just add that since it's something I would have expected you to, it's coming from the Cato Institute to have raised, and so since you didn't, I will.
Okay.
I don't mean to argue that the market has sole responsibility, that it's that the market is the only thing which is stands between the realization of community, or that the only the market is undermined community. The state, the modern nation state, has been very aggressively undermining all other forms of community since at least the French Revolution. And we see this in the most dramatic forms in terms of the Nazis and the Soviet communists. The liberal democracies have done the same thing. As I say, it goes back much further, at least to the French Revolution, where the national community became endowed with a legitimacy that no other left no room for any other community. So the state, and sometimes, the Mexican example, I think, is a very good one, where the state and the market have worked in tandem. The state has used the market in order to, as I think the elites of Mexico would agree, to bring the peasants into the 21st century. And if they have to be brought in kicking and screaming, well, so be it, but they're going to be brought in one way or the other for their own good. Well, now, elites have had this notion of for their own good for a long, long time as the basis of undermining community, and have used both the market and the state to do so.
Well, I agree with that. That was in my notes, so thanks thanks for bringing it up. I mean, I'm of two minds about the
good.
These very, very abstract, broad nation state, where in some ways, and I'm sure you agree with, like, civil rights legislation, when the sort of more abstract, centralized, state sort of trumps the pernicious norms of the local community, we feel like the Jim Crow South. Was a real community that was deeply meaningful to the people embedded in it, but we think that was a world well lost, and a lot of people applaud the state's initiative in basically breaking down the norms that held those communities together, and part of me is very much in favor of that, but at the same time I think along with you, very skeptical of the effects of the state in crowding out things like self-help societies, the civic societies, the fraternal organizations that people used to use as a kind of as their form of social insurance. When the state crowds that out, I think that does have a corrosive effect on community. But I think there are really difficult trade-offs that I do get really worried about the illiberal aspects of and the conformism of the local community. So I don't really know how to weigh off the benefits of sort of abstraction versus particularity very well in my own thinking.
Well, all I can do is say amen to what you've said, because I do think it's a difficult thing to do. But, you're already there if you take these issues seriously and recognize, indeed, that there are trade-offs. You're already, I think, at the point that I am trying to bring the economics profession through this book. Let me say, I don't flatter myself that for sociologists, anthropologists, historians, people outside the economics profession, that there's a lot that is going to be startling or surprising or that they will find to disagree with in this. It's because I think that people outside of economics, a lot of what I say, and it seems I find that you echo it, is kind of obvious that we do have, and as I started with, Rabbi Hillel put it very concisely 2,000 years ago, the individual and the community are in tension. This is a healthy, creative tension. But what's happened over the last 400 years is that we've gone very much to one end of the spectrum. And this tension has been resolved much too much in favor of the individual and against the community. So what I want to do is help restore that tension and get us away from a way of thinking and a way of being in the world which obliterates the tension by making the community invisible. So once you recognize that there are, as you put it, I'm kind of resist the language of trade-offs, but fair enough. Once you recognize that that these trade-offs are real and exist, then I say you're an ally in my efforts.
All right. Well, we're officially friends now, I guess. thanks so much for coming on. I think we're out of time. I did want to say that I disagree with a lot of the upshot of the book. I found it a lot in it to agree with, and I found it extremely stimulating. And so I highly recommend it, your book. It's called The Dismal Science: How Thinking Like an Economist Undermines Community. Professor Marglin, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
All right. Take care.